Right.
So this is a public hearing, excuse me. So this is a public hearing that has been warned and information, a press release sent out how many weeks ago? 4 weeks ago, and then again more recently. The working group, this working group is made up of citizens who have been elected to the legislature or appointed as judges or to the administration or to the public service board. So the people on the working group are very interested in hearing what other citizens have to say about the ease of participation in public service board proceedings. Our group was established pursuant to its charge under the 2016 Acts and Resolves number 174, section 15B, and we intend to make recommendations by December 15th to the House and Senate committees on Natural Resources and Energy, the Senate Committee on Finance, and the Joint Energy Committee, all of which are composed of citizens elected to our citizen legislature in the state of Vermont. So having said that, we have folks in the room who have come to testify, and we will take testimony for, we've asked for 2 minutes apiece, and we're going to be, you have a list?
As of right now, Mr. Whitaker is...
Mr. Whitaker, you're the only person signed up, so if you don't mind, you have 2 minutes to testify. Oh, sure. Why don't we introduce ourselves as we begin? So, Judge Mellow, you're first.
I'm Bob Mellow. I'm a superior judge. I represent the judiciary on the committee.
And I'm Margaret Cheney. I'm a member of the Public Service Board, appointed by the board as required by Act 174.
Senator Jenny Lyons, I'm chairing the working group.
And I'm Chris Recchio. I'm the commissioner of the Public Service Department.
And still Representative Tom.
Okay, so Steve, you're up, and then who's next after that?
Jason K.
Oh, yeah, you're the next.
Jason.
Here, hand it to Margaret.
Sorry,
that's good. Okay. You're up.
Am I truly limited to 2 minutes?
You are limited to 2 minutes. That was a rule we put in place, and.
And even if there's only two people.
Please sit down, and you can share what you have to say.
Because we don't want to listen to you.
Well, I share the comments made in the background that it's somewhat insulting to tell people ahead of time that if they have a story to tell about trying to participate in public utilities regulation, that if they can't tell in 2 minutes, don't bother coming.
All right, I'm going to interrupt you right now. We publicized this, and we also indicated that anyone who testifies has a right to bring written comments. Those written comments may extend beyond 2 minutes. This is essentially the same as any other public hearing that we have had in the State House for as long as I have been in the Senate and beyond.
Senator, I didn't mean to offend anybody.
You did offend. You offended all of us. So now what I would like for you to do is to offer your testimony.
Okay, well, I meant it as an example that in a public hearing before the Public Service Board, of which I have attended several, I've never been constrained to that degree, that in effect the Public Service Board and its sister agency, so to speak, the department, have a long road to hoe to regain public confidence and trust. It's been years in the making, that erosion, and these are comments that I haven't made in my prior opportunities before the committee. They're a little bit more sensitive, but they are meriting a public airing. The examples that I would, and many of them are on the themes of the need for, at least in the interim, that the need for an independent public advocate continually arises and is continually not invoked by the board. And I would even think the department has the ability to request the Attorney General to appoint a public advocate when necessary. But when you have cases like the tens of millions at stake of contractually required refunded money to ratepayers on the Green Mountain Power merger, I'm going to try to stick to closed cases here, or the service quality docket that was settled with an MOU without ever digging into the issues around 911. When you have these, and then you have years of renewals of the Verizon passed over to Fairpoint incentive regulation plan, which is not a pending open docket as far as I know, but how that incentive regulation plan was approved in the absence of a 10-year telecommunications plan, which is required to be the basis. A finding of consistency is required to be a basis. So every one of these situations are examples where a independent public advocate could easily, true, there's a cost to that, but that function provides an essential gateway for less sophisticated participants to engage in the process and leave it to that independent, they're almost always lawyers. Sadek was one, and that's why I had originally made him aware of this process and said, please come and speak, and then he came and spoke, and he didn't focus on that issue at all. He was the most effective independent public advocate that, in my experience, because he took on the entire VTA contract regulation case, and he focused the testimony from the independent, the public access stations, telecommunications consultants. All right, I'm to be shut up.
Well, we get your point. We get your point. It's well taken.
But there is a, it's borderline, there's an approachability issue with the board and with the department that used to not be impeded. I've given the commissioner an example where you come into the department now, where you used to be able to come in and ask to see some records. Now you have to make an appointment to a person who doesn't answer the phone. You come into the vestibule on the third floor and hit the telecommunications number on the phone, and it goes to a dead line. This was a month ago. You go to the public service board, and there's three people sitting in the front office, yet none of them are allowed to find you a copy of something. Everything has to wait for days. And I just think if you want to look at a decision in the binders in the library, that should be open and accessible. The idea that no one except a clerk or a deputy clerk can find records that are supposed to be available for inspection during business hours. Those are simple changes that could be made to make the process more accessible.
That's good. Thank you. And I know you've also given us some written testimony, and you did offer some information at the last meeting.
I haven't given you written testimony because I'm spread thin trying to...
Well, maybe you just gave it to me. I don't know what I saw.
Make up for...
Okay, thank you. Good. Jason Kay. So we're trying to restrict ourselves to 2 minutes apiece, but obviously we just went to about five.
Hi there.
How are you?
Good. Thanks for having this hearing. My name is Jason Kay. I live in Middlebury. I'm the chairperson of our town's Energy Committee. Though I'm not here, or I am here on my own behalf. Most of my experience with the Public Service Board has been associated with the Vermont Gas System Expansion dockets over the last 4 years. I've had kind of difficulty in trying to articulate my thoughts to this group, so here goes. In my opinion, Section 248 is a concentration of immense power in the executive branch. Board members are appointed by the governor, the department, ANR, Agency of Agriculture, the Comprehensive Energy Plan, all of which have a significant, and I would suggest controlling, stake at the board or in board proceedings, are fully under the control of the governor. the suggestions that have been floated among this working group, including the PSB, filing templates, a better citizen's guide, name changes, and even possibly intervener funding, do nothing to relinquish control over this process from the executive branch. The sole exception is the suggestion to transfer siting decisions to Act 250's district commissions, which is a slight step toward empowering communities. In a few months, of course, Commissioner Arprecchio will be moving on, as will Representative Klein, Chairperson Volz, and Governor Shumlin. But the institutional issues with the Section 248 process will remain. The charge of this working group is limited in scope and therefore will not address the real issue with this process, which is a concentration of power away from the public. Thank you.
Thank you.
And just for the record, he had another quarter of a second to go if he wanted to.
So because nobody's here, can we ask them a question?
We'll see if there are how many other people wish to testify, and then we can ask questions. Please come up.
Setting my time on Okay, my name is Melanie Pizer. I have been a witness in public service board hearings as well as assisted my mom pro se to file intervener requests in two separate cases, one for herself on a docket and a change that she considered to be substantial, and in the other on the delay inquiry regarding Vermont Gas's failure to notify of its increased budget. I'm going to be submitting written comments, but there are just a few things that I would like to say. My background is actually in justice reform, so I've spent much of my career looking at the organization of legal assistance for vulnerable individuals, how individuals navigate administrative justice systems, as well as citizen court and citizen police relations. I know that it's un-Vermont-y to say anything about the way that individuals interact in our system and to always suggest that it's a structure or a system problem and not a cultural problem. But I urge you to look at the cultural issues in this case, dismissing citizen perceptions as simply that and wrong or dependent upon the outcome of a case is not only statistically unsupported in research, it's also simply incorrect. Citizens in Vermont do understand the difference between a fair process and an unfair process, and they understand the balancing of interests. I think you need to look very critically, whether that's through surveys or defensible focus groups, with good groups of individuals, meaning well-selected in an objective and social science-supportable manner. Simply taking the views of someone like me, who's very passionate about this issue, and 15 other people who are passionate about the issue, but are highly competent in navigating this system, is going to skew your results. You simply have no idea what it is like for the average Vermonter to try to navigate this system.
So are we getting your written comments?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Good. Is there anyone else who would like to come up and speak for 2 minutes or more? Okay. Then we might have questions for you, so if you don't mind indulging us. Go ahead.
So I have a couple of questions for both of you, Melody, and I'm sorry.
Jason K.
And
Melody Pizer.
And Jason. And I've been observing the Public Service Board for well over 20 years. I've watched three of the, I think there's only been four chairs. History. The only one I didn't really watch in action, although I was here, was Dick Sawdick. But I watched very closely Rich Coward and What's that?
No, I was counting if there was more.
We were counting.
We were trying to count if there were more than four. Well, sorry to distract you.
Right.
Yeah, go ahead.
And I understand, may I call you Melanie? I understand what you're saying, and what I want to know is that are we talking about access to a process, or are we talking about what influences a decision? You know, what is it that goes into the decision? Because I think I'm hearing Nathan, is that?
Jason.
I'm sorry. You know, because I keep hearing a common theme, I think, is that nobody listens to us. And so I'm wondering if it's about access to a process, or how do we as citizens understand what we're putting into the process, how that weighs into what kind of weight that gets in the decision. Is that what you're actually asking for?
No, I think that these are two separate questions, but I think that what I'm hearing and what you're asking is the age-old question regarding education. Are you asking for equality of opportunity or equality of outcome? And I think that is a false question. The question that I believe this working group ought to be asking is, what we know what the symptoms are. We know that the Public Service Board has a serious public perception problem. We know that people think the system is rigged. We know that people think it isn't fair. You are responding to that by saying that's because people don't like the outcome, but that doesn't mean that they don't have access to the process. You don't actually know, A, why they are saying it, because you haven't asked enough people to get a defensible group selection. You don't have an N equals 15, even the very bare minimum of an objectively selected group of people to give you an answer to that. And B, you haven't then asked them questions that would let you drill down to look at the mechanics of what's going on. So you're hearing the symptom, but you don't have the information that you need in order to determine what is the real problem here. What in the mechanics could change that would satisfy the individuals that have the concern? And you're dealing with, I don't think you really have anybody testify about this who is a millennial. For example, you haven't had anybody testify who is over 80. You're not looking at the range of people who are actually coming into the system, or the full range of people who are coming for what purpose or what reason. And so I think you simply don't have the information you need, but you're not going about it in a way that is going to get it for you. But I do believe that there are problems that are in the mechanics, that when people are saying they don't listen, it's because there are problems in the way that the process is happening. And we'll use the get signed without all of the parties in the room. The get signed behind closed doors do actually undermine the process. And they do undermine the extent to which stakeholders in the outcome have had an influence. It is not simply when you walk into the technical hearing room or file a brief that these things are happening. What's happening in terms of Act 174 and giving a preference for natural gas, for example, and saying that municipal planning that does not include that preference or that bars natural gas transmission is not compliant. That is front-ending decision-making before it gets to this process. So when you're hearing that people think it's rigged and that they can't influence it, you're thinking, well, that's not how the process is designed, right? But there have been overlays and changes in legislation and changes in the way that the executive branch has acted and decided to handle the process and manipulate the process to get a certain outcome that has resulted in people having a decreased level of influence on the outcome. And I believe that's what you are hearing in all of the complaints, is that there are all these other things happening and people no longer believe that what happens in the technical hearing room is the reflection of a fair process. They believe it's a reflection of manipulation of many other elements that have undermined administrative justice. That's my personal belief.
have enough information yet to know whether it's true. It's my hypothesis. I believe there are many other reasons and many other changes that could be made in the process that would help to ameliorate both some of the public concern and actually make the process more fair.
I've heard both of you talk about the undue influence of the executive branch. And I'm kind of, you know, thinking that, well, that yes, the governor appoints the Public Service Board commissioners. They're 6-year terms, so they go beyond the terms of the governor. So that was one of the reasons why they were 6-year terms, to try and put more of a firewall between the being directly accountable to a governor. Your current chair was originally appointed by a Republican governor and was reappointed by a Democrat governor. Act 250, every district commissioner is appointed by a governor. So I don't know how you get away from that. When we go to the, you know, when the suggestion for public advocate, which I think is a great idea, but when you begin to think about the nuts and bolts, well, how would that work? Who's going to pay for it? Who is going to pay for it? How many public advocates are there going to be? If you've got 100 projects going through the system, and maybe 25 of them could be contentious, who gets to the top of the feed line to get the public advocate's attention, you know, to deal with I'll say your viewpoint on it. So, you know, when you try and work through, and I'm sure they can be worked through, but I don't know how you get away from I guess maybe I shouldn't say it, but I will. Everything seems to be, and I don't mean here, and I don't mean just in the public service process, but everything seems to be have some conspiracy attached to it, and I find that really disheartening. And I'm not saying anybody here thinks that there's a conspiracy, but again, I think I said it in the, and then I'll shut up, Madam Chair. I think I said it in our first meeting that a permit process, Act 250 permit process, even the CPG process, which is actually a permit process, the understanding is that a permit will be issued unless there are extraordinary circumstances that they don't meet, or they can't deliver the project under the good conditions that have been placed upon them. I'll stop there because I see the hand.
Yeah. Could I come up to that chair? And
sure.
I'd like to address what Representative Klein said. I've heard him say it so many times.
Okay, so this is your 2 minutes.
Yeah.
And there you go. I got your name down.
Can you state your name?
Yes. John Brabant. I presently work for Vermonters for Clean Environment, but I just want to respond to Representative Klein's statement about folks who apply for permits, or permits that are applied for, are near, you didn't use the term guaranteed, but that's the effect that generally we just issue permits. And I just want to, you know, you folks weren't there. I went to a training many years ago.
They're supposed to get their permits.
Well, no, they're not supposed to. Actually, that is the result, Representative Klein, 99.9% of the time, but no one is supposed to get anything. Permits, I'm going to quote Pat Parento, who taught a training at Act 250 while, and he was pretty new to law school then, that I attended as an A&R official many years ago, and 250 officials were there as well. It was about getting us up to speed on kind of how permitting law works. And he said that permits are basically permission to cause damage to the environment, that no one has a right to a permit, that standards are set in statute and in, you know, of course, rule, that create avenues for people to impair the environment because there are necessities, right? You know, we all impair the environment. Our physical existence as Americans results in us impairing the environment. We are a very consumptive society.
Do you agree with Paul Ehrlich?
Pardon me?
No, go
ahead. Yeah, no, it's okay. We can have a conversation. That's what I'd like to have anyway. So he was saying, you know, actually, if you go and you pollute the water, that's a criminal offense. Unless you have a permit. That's the theatrics or what we're also including Mr. Parento's conversation with us, an education of us, that, but nobody is entitled to a permit until and unless you meet the standards, the criteria.
Yes.
And if you meet the criteria, you deserve a permit. And those criteria can be changed and are changed and adjusted up or down. And I think the problem is the criteria, maybe if people are feeling significantly impacted by any particular project, and the process is not responsive to their concerns, then the criteria need to be looked at again. And, you know, I know there's this feeling, sentiment against considering moving siting to Act 250. And Act 250 has had its complaints over the years, but 99 or 98.9% of the permits, I don't know what the exact number is, but it's up in that range, that go through Act 250 get permitted. Yep. And most are through the minor process. Right. And you don't hear people screaming. And I think that...
Well, I would disagree there. You do hear people screaming.
Well, but on a very minor percentage of projects. But most of them you don't hear people screaming about. The problem is, if you look at the PSB, it seems like all renewable energy projects, or not all, but most of them, people are screaming about. And I don't think it's because people are against renewables.
I think this is
that's a perception.
Well,
and
the statistics would bear out what you just said.
No, because 99.
No. I mean that they would. That
you think that 99%
is the same as
that
250?
No, I think there are thousands of projects that are permitted that nobody has any comments on.
That's right. That's right. You permit even the smallest scale projects. Sorry, I mean. I meant the large.
I'm not disagreeing with the general point you're making, but in terms of proportionality, I do.
Yeah, okay. And I erred, you're correct, because you permit the most minute projects if they connect to the grid. But the large-scale projects, I guess I should say, there's a lot of concern about the process that leads to permitting them. And citizen access and municipal access, and when I say access, that means having real effect to sway the process and steer the process. I'm a municipal official outside of my VCE hat, and I serve on the select board of my town. And, you know, we are all very concerned. And our select board, I really value our select board because we are cross-spectrum. We are, I think we're probably politically all Ds or Ps, but there's very conservative people on our board and there's very left-of-center people. And we're all of one mind that, you know, we're very upset about this town's not, I don't like the term veto. When someone comes up to me and says, oh, you want renewables to towns to have this, say, to deny a particular project at a particular scale or location or a particular type, I usually come back to them and say, you know, you're pretty engaged. Do you have zoning in your town? Why, yes. And does your zoning regulate the siting of housing? Why, yes. Shopping malls? Of course. So if your zoning regulates housing, does that mean, should I construe that, and you support it, should I construe that to mean that you're all about hindering the development of housing? Are you against people having houses to live in? Are you against having houses in your town? Are you against supermarkets being built where people can buy food? Are you anti-supermarket? Of course not. It just means we want to be able to steer development and site it where it's most appropriate in our particular town and or region. You work with the region. The problem, this whole thing that's been this drumbeat that if you support municipal say over siting of renewables, you're anti-renewable. It's been really damaging to the whole cause, which I believe I have renewable hot water on my house, and you know, I'm just from VPIRG. And I find this whole conversation where this whole thing has gone, the fact that it's so adversarial, and I saw it at the legislature, it's really bad. And it's going to continue to be, so long as the PSB, whether the siting stays at the PSB or not long term, so long as the PSB is, as we heard in Representative Klein's committee, or Senator Bray's committee, more judicial than quasi. Act 250 is more quasi than judicial. It is a very friendly process to the citizenry. Attorneys complain many times because they like the PSB process. It's really attorney-oriented. They love it. But it's not good for the people they're representing. It costs them money. And it's not good for communities, and it's not good for citizens. And the process, you're going to continue to be beaten around the head until you grapple with this reality. Act 250 is a better process than the PSB. That is just the absolute truth. It wasn't, PSB process was not designed for the types of projects that are going through it now. You folks are being inundated with even the smallest projects, citing the smallest projects. 250 has the capacity to handle that. They do this all the time. They've got staff, they have a real good relationship with A&R. And lastly, there's no department of, I don't know, we have a Department of Public Service and we have a Public Service Board. There's no department out there that cuts MOUs representing the public service that would, or an equivalent under Act 250. The problem is the Public Service Department, and this goes cross-administration all the way back in time, is they cut deals, and that's just what it is. And the public is not present, and they come in, and that's got incredible weight. And it's so damaging to the Public Service Board, and it's kind of not their fault, but it's the fault of the statute that allows for this. It's a problem.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So when you say MOUs are damaging, do you mean, explain damaging.
It's certain, this, you know, we're all about, okay, if you're going to be quasi-judicial, let's put all our cards on the table. So the citizens, you know, they lawyer up, as it were, and they hire an attorney, and they invest, you know, tens and even hundreds of thousands of dollars to put their case together. All the while, there are meetings going on. No one knows they're going on at A&R. They're having their MOU meetings. DPS, I think they call them, stipulated settlement agreements, whatever. And those things are done behind closed doors with the developers, and that is where the governor has influence, quite frankly, and I don't want to misspeak Commissioner Recchia, but I think you might have said, hey, I'm pretty sure you said that you work for the governor, and the people elected the governor, and the governor is like the face of the public, and so, you know, what he says is representing the public, so the public's position. And if they elect a different governor, then that governor's voice would be that of the public. And that's not really right.
No, it's not.
But I think that was the gist. And
any
governor is just a person, and he or she cannot be all-knowing. But the MOU process happens in secret, and then it shows up. At the very least, you know, what A&R did, what the legislature did, A&R used to cut these settlement agreements for enforcement actions called assurances of discontinuance. And they were all done in secret, and they were sprung on the public who was concerned, and they didn't always agree with the terms, and their issues were commonly not addressed. And they felt shorted. And then what do? They got to go to court and appeal that. And so the legislature made a very good decision in changing the law, saying that there had to be public notice of draft assurance of discontinuance. Senator Lyons shaking her head. I think she probably was key to that happening some years ago. And that took the edge off. You don't hear people complaining about it anymore because they have an opportunity.
So to clarify then, it sounds what I'm hearing in what you just said is that MOUs are damaging either or both, because they circumvent the process or because they erode public trust?
Both. The circumvention of the process, erodes public trust. And then, you know, that gets heaped on the public service board. And, you know, like it or not, your process is keyed in with the DPS. There's a very close relationship, and that was intended. That doesn't exist in 250. And so you don't have that. Yes, A&R can come in with a memorandum of understanding, but it's got a different effect than a commissioner of public service coming in with the same thing.
Let me ask you a question, and we probably should let someone else.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Speak. Didn't mean to filibuster here.
You said some very helpful things. If, let's just suppose that the process were such that all deliberations, not deliberations, but all information and all discussion happened in an open meeting and nothing happened behind closed doors. And let's suppose that the decision that the decision is based on expert testimony that the board chooses from what it is presented, which is under state, that's under the law, under 248, anything that citizens bring is used to identify issues. We heard that initially from Aaron Adler and from June Tierney. So that is the law. Mm-hmm. So the law as it is, would the open meeting process, I call it an open meeting process, ameliorate the concerns?
I think settlements are important. It saves all parties money. And sometimes because of that cost savings and the kind of guarantee, the greater guarantee of an outcome for the developer, allows the developer to go beyond what they might not normally offer up. But I think all parties need to be present in those settlement discussions, and those discussions should only be had with all parties present. And then the playing field remains level. And it's in the interest of neighbors to projects to reach settlement. I mean, it might be only a bush or two, or, you know, moving into
it.
Yeah, right. And so, but the neighbors need to be there. And I think it would, you know, lighten the workload for the PSB too. So people are challenging these settlement agreements, and not very effectively. And, you know, Mr. Recchi is getting beat about the head every day, the poor guy. But I think if this were required, and you know, I'm going to say required in the law or the rule, then the commissioner wouldn't feel pressured, the next commissioner even, wouldn't feel so pressured, because a new precedent would be the new approach in terms of the process would require that all parties be invited in and actively engaged in settlement discussions. So that's what these are.
And then it's a matter of defining party.
Yeah.
I mean, all the usual.
I mean, what happened at... I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Finish your thought.
What exit is that in Randolph? That
four.
Was, exit four. Your town. I mean, all the parties were involved. The process kind of crash-landed. There were some problems there, as I understand it, but all the parties participated in settlement discussions, and I don't think any of those parties would complain that the process is broken, because it allows for that all-inclusive settlement process. The problem is when only certain parties, and the parties with the most money and the most power, are the ones that have the ear, catch the ear. I don't know if there's ever been a case where the DPS has engaged a citizen and said, hey, let's cut a deal and let's leave the developer out. I don't think that's ever happened. I don't think it ever would until, and I don't think that's appropriate either.
No, I get it. May I just, first of all, I just want to acknowledge, I think you elegantly described on the whole permit process and what the expectations are. It was one of the best explanations I've ever heard, and I really, you know, I appreciate it and know you know this, so.
Flattery will get you everywhere.
Excellent. Then let me keep going. I think that, you know, where I would agree with you about is that the the public service board process is not user-friendly from a citizen standpoint, and Act 250 is. And I also agree with the concept of quasi versus judicial. That is a good description of what is going on there. I think it's really important, though. So here's one correction, and it may not be relevant, but the Exit 4 example, actually three of the parties negotiated, and one that was excluded from that was Citizens Against Exit 4, or I don't know their exact name, but there was a group that was actively involved in that process that was excluded from those negotiations.
Right, and that was what caused the breakdown. I'm aware of that.
That is probably true. And one, so let me say two things. One is you're also right that with the A&R processes with stipulated judgments or notices of discontinuance, those were executed as after notices of violation, which are public but not often read, right? And you know that. And I think I was Deputy Secretary of A&R when we did that change to make a public notice on those, and I agree with that. And I'd even be willing to do a public notice on proposed settlements with DPS. But here are two examples of things that would not have happened if we had to. If you have to include all parties, even if you know that one of the parties' exclusive objection is to do everything possible to stop the project. So that's different than, I've got a couple of bushes I want moved, or even, you know, fundamentally, I disagree with your project, but, you know, I'm willing to work with you to try and make it the best that it can be. If you have parties that are doing that, I think you stand a pretty good chance of getting to a settlement. If you don't, and you got somebody who participates in this, forgive me, but either to delay or obstruct, or participate to gain information and then obstruct and delay later, that's a problem to get somebody into the room to start negotiating. Things that would not have happened, we would not have a Vermont Yankee settlement from 2013, December 23rd, 2013, where we had an effective close down of that facility and a constructive settlement to make sure that we closed the site well, and that the Vermonters were taken care of, both local Vermonters and the state, in terms of a path to move forward. It just would not have happened if we had to involve all parties. That said, another example is TDI, the underground cable, and the negotiations that occurred there. That would not have happened if everybody were in the room together. On the other hand, and this is a transparency issue, and I grant you it's a problem, I talked with all the parties of both of those cases before they were settled. So I called
the Yankee and TDI.
Yeah. So I call people, talk to them about where we were, ask them what they thought, heard what they thought, and then proceeded accordingly. Did I incorporate everything they wanted? No. But did I listen to them and try and gain that information before settling? Yes. On the TDI project, CLF had announced a settlement with them in advance of us. And they knew that their settlement was, at that point, they knew their settlement was going to be far less than ours was going to be. But they wanted to get on the record with the settlement. I said, as long as we all know what we're doing. You know where I am, and I know now where you are. And they announced their settlement probably a month before we announced ours. But they were supportive of ours, and they knew where we were headed. I can't, you know, how do you do this? But the main point I want to make is, you're also right that any settlement that occurred in a notice of discontinuance or something like that needs to then go right to court. These settlements go to the Public Service Board, and parties that don't sign on to the settlement are free to argue about them. And the other point I want to make, and I think it's really critical, and it's probably shooting myself in the foot, but luckily not for very long, is that I think the Public Service Board should question why we do what we did and how we did what we did, and listen to other parties before they endorse a settlement, and I think they, in the case of Yankee, they did do that. There were at least two other parties that were not supportive of that settlement, and we went through days of hearings to discuss why we did what we did and why we came to the conclusions we did, and the board was free to adjust those if they wished to. So, again, though, not to diminish anything you said, because it is not a friendly process, because it is a litigious adversarial process, and that's the way it's structured. Is that appropriate for electrical generation facilities? Excuse me, in the history we had, perhaps. Is it appropriate for siting, where it looks, starts to look more and more like zoning and less like energy? I am of the mind that we have to have a better system that reflects the zoning piece, and that's why, unfortunately, concurrent with this, you can drive with me down to exit 4, we can go to Randolph's together. There's a hearing tonight on the standards to have municipal and regional plans given.
Yeah, we're in the
difference. I know, I can't either, and I do want to try and make this, but I think we could all go, and we could continue this hearing down there, and unfortunately public notice couldn't work out. But I think, I appreciate a lot of your points, and I think they are, they're astute, they are, I'll close with another compliment so that we can continue to do this. They are astute, they're well-founded, and they're from experience, and I appreciate that.
If I can just, and this is not a rebuttal, this is just kind of clarification. I've given the zoning things, and I look very differently at these renewables that just show up on our doorstep. This is not part of a large planning process. This is like, hey, there's an incentive program out there. I can build it on my parking lot, or I can build it in my backyard, and I'm going to do it. And so there. And it's not meant to be adversarial, but people don't think about the neighbors. There's money to be made. Like, if I was going to put a shopping center on, Farmer Jones's farm that I came from, I don't know, Kentucky, and it looks like a good flat piece of land there, and I could put a nice shopping center there. They don't have a Walmart in that town. And you infuriate the whole community who's got this longer history. But anyway, you cannot, as far as I understand, you cannot zone out housing. When I hear that term, we shouldn't allow towns a veto on energy, a renewable energy project. I think that is not fair. I think you should not be able to ban renewable energy projects anywhere in your town.
State law says you can't.
Right, and you should not be able to. Well, I think the state law right now is bad, and quite frankly, we're not going to address that today.
It just simply says that a town cannot zone out.
Right, but
renewable energy.
Right.
Just what you said.
Right. Just like you can't zone out any development. But the problem is the current law says that you must, in this regulation that's about to come into place, says that, and actually we can't put it in zoning. The law says you cannot zone for a renewable energy project, which I think is bad. I think that it's land use like anything else, and you should be able to cite and zone for that.
So I want to. We're starting to drift, and I don't want us to do that. But I will say that very much appreciate your comments.
Yeah.
And
okay. So, Madam Chair, I have a question for you. How many of the solar projects, for example, the thousands of them that have been cited, would trigger 250?
I don't know.
Not many.
No. I mean, it has to be an acre of impervious surface to do that.
So that's
at least under the public service board process, they get an overview, no matter how small they are. There's some oversight. I'm not saying that's good or bad. I'm just trying to point out that there's no perfect system for any of this stuff.
And not to debate, but that's important that the Public Service Board does take a look at even the smallest ones. But I think that's unfortunate. I think that could be handled through zoning. And zoning could do the review within the Public Service Board.
We hear you, and we heard
it would save a lot of stuff.
But just one comment.
How many towns have...
Just one comment.
Well, that's their problem.
No, not that.
Well, but, and the truth, I mean, we're not debating.
We're not debating.
No,
we are not debating.
Listen, discussion.
But I am going to say that, remember, there's another aspect of this, which is energy planning and grid management and reliability, stability, and ensuring that going forward we're going to have all the electrons we need on board. So it is citing, there's no question about it, and that is a huge issue, we understand that. But it also carries for sort of the economics of electrons.
So can I share with you?
Joshua.
Jason.
He did it to me. So why don't you?
Thanks, Joe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's good. It's a good conversation, and well, I'm sure that this isn't the end of it.
If I may respond directly to Representative Ryan's comments earlier, there are two points I want to address. Both of them are really important.
Can you come here? So
yeah, we can't hear you.
Thanks. And thank you for coming all the way to Melbourne.
Sure. So there are two points I want to address, and I think they are worthy of much deeper discussion, which I don't think we have the time to do so here. I'm going to talk about the first one first, but I would like to focus more on the second question. The first is that the notion that permits will be issued kind of no matter what, and the permitting process is really just to kind of shape how a project gets approved. I think that if that is so, then that is the conspiracy theory. That is in fact true.
Well, I think Mr. Brabeck clarified that, and I didn't disagree with what he said. It was just a better definition than what I was trying to say.
Right. So, well, I think that's where a lot of, when I first went to board proceedings, it was always stated that the permit is not approved until it's approved.
Right.
It could go either way, but it seems that there is so much momentum behind the project that it will be approved no matter what, that's where I think the skepticism, at least for myself as a member of the public, comes from. But that kind of leads me into the second question, which is gets more at the heart of it, is whether we or you are discussing access to the process or access to decision making. That's
Let's talk about that. What are you going to say about that?
Well, I think that's the question that needs to be fundamentally addressed. The charge of this group, ease of participation, I think limits us from discussing that question.
Well, state law currently says that the decision making lies with the Public Service Board, and sort of regardless of what citizen information comes forward, unless it's accepted as expert witness testimony.
Citizen comment though is relevant, but they are the decision makers. It's not like a vote at town meeting.
And I think that's a really interesting question to get to in this new energy paradigm: is should the decision making power be solely with the 3-member Public Service Board? Or should it be somehow opened up to more people? It would be a very complicated thing to work through. I certainly don't have a framework for it. And it could, probably would result in some projects not moving forward.
So one of the witnesses last week talked about allowing for towns to have decision-making power over siting, the same way that municipalities have decision-making over where telecommunications towers go. That is in statute. And so one of the comments was to allow for that for renewable energy projects.
I think the question that I'm, or the fundamental component that I'm getting to, applies to all projects underneath the Public Service Board jurisdiction, whether it's renewable or fossil or telecommunications.
Whatever.
I kind of see that the suggestions coming from this working group could ease access to the process, which counts for something, maybe. But if there's no access to the actual decision making,
well, that's what I'm asking you. Can you define what you mean by that second part? part. Is it that you would like to have the municipality make a decision about where the project goes or the rate that's charged to citizens within the town, trying to figure out what decisions and how you would implement that decision-making change?
To the first part of that question, I think it's more of a, let's see, how do I say it? Well, maybe I'll start with the second part. I don't know what that process would look like. Okay. And far be it for one person to actually decide how the public participates. Commissioner Recchio brought up an interesting part of this, is that if a group or an individual, some part of the public, doesn't want a project to go forward, what do we do with that? Do we, I mean, I think as of now, the way that we've been dealing with it is by saying, well, push it off to the side. So do we, going forward, actually give that greater weight? You know, town vote, I don't think that's the best way to do it. But that's a good, it's a good brainstorm to have if that's what we want to discuss, decision-making power.
It's not in our charge, but it certainly has risen up, and you know, little bubbles coming up every time we meet, so it's helpful for you to bring this up.
Thank you. Thanks. Oh, before you leave, may I ask a question or just an idea? See his reaction to an idea?
Can sure.
Okay. She's nervous. So one concept to address that concern that we had was maybe initial meeting, reaching out to all the parties that are of record and saying, this is the type of discussion we'd like to have to get from here to there. Would you be interested in participating? And, you know, contingent on that is, are you willing to participate constructively? If the answer is yes, then we move forward. And if the answer is no, we can politely say, okay, thank you. You know, we'll let you know if we come up with something that you can then respond to before the Public Service Board. But it still can get messy in the sense that people could say, with all genuine belief, yes, I'm willing to try and get from here to there, but at, you know, you might get 90% of the way there, and it might fall apart, and that's just part of the process. But you know, I don't know how to effectively do that if there's not any agreement that we reach with anybody for any reason needs to be defended before that very process that everybody's describing as so onerous, with witnesses, with cross-examination, with discovery. Who did you ask? Who did you talk to? What did you do? And why? And that needs to be, you know, defended through that very onerous process. That if a party is not engaged with that, could then effectively rebut the agreement that was reached. But I would love to find a place in between those two where you can constructively engage parties. Because if every case that went to court or to a judicial proceeding had to proceed from start to finish without settlement, I can't even imagine what our court, I mean, our court systems are already completely backed up, and these guys are already working.
Well, so I would just then kind of take that a little bit further. Would one consider constructive participation being presenting the option that the project doesn't go forward?
Mm-hmm. Right. I think it's a fair question.
Yeah.
So, thank you.
I'm trying to remember my train of thought, but essentially the way I hear
told you to write it down.
Essentially, the way I think about what you said is two different things. I think it was valuable for you to raise the distinction. One is public participation in the process, and the other is public participation in the decision, right? So we've been focusing on process and decision making. So I'm curious, how do you think of the public? Because Commissioner Recchio has been talking about parties, for example, and others here have been talking about towns. How do you think about the public? For example, there are some projects that are in one town, and there are some projects that span many towns. And somebody's curious, and don't want to put you on the spot, but when you think of the public being involved in the decision, who is the public to you?
Well, the easy and difficult answer is everybody.
You mean Vermonters? Or who's everybody?
Right, yeah, that's interesting. I mean, certainly folks within the state, and there has been.
So is it a democratic involvement, for example, voters? If you haven't thought about it, that's fine. I was just curious if you had a paradigm in mind.
Just that I think the public should be as inclusive as possible.
Okay, thanks.
Can I just respond to this question of participating constructively in settlement?
Well, we can't hear you.
I'd just like to address this question of participating constructively in settlement negotiations. I think you have to recognize that this is an adversarial process. And as Jason said, well, would you consider it constructive if the party simply does not want the project to go forward? I think you're looking at this with a bias toward the project going forward, because the utility is not going to settle unless the utility gets the project to go forward. So is that party also not constructive?
No, I think that...
Right,
valid,
because...
I hope I acknowledged it to Jason. Right. I think that's a valid consideration that should be given thought as to whether this occurs, but... You know, we're not going to enter into a settlement discussion to approve a project that we disagree with.
Right.
Right?
Right. And this is sort of my point, right? You're not entering as a constructive party who would be willing to consider the option of the project not being approved, correct? Is that being part of the settlement? In other words, the parties could pay the utility, for example.
A developer can, and has reached agreement with a party or two to approve a project that we have opposed. You know, it happens. I think I hear what you're saying, that there's nothing wrong with a discussion to at least find out where people are, and if they're opposed to a project, why. And, you know, and we in the department, I think we go back to Jason's point, and I don't want to argue with this, but Vermonters are the public that we are trying to serve. That means we don't necessarily always satisfy everybody in the project, landowners, other parties, other participants who have a different point of view. The gas pipeline is a perfect example. But we are trying to represent what's in the public interest, and we do try and listen to all points of view to try and integrate that. And there are things that we, I think, have done recently and are doing better to try and make that a more, because that can be an easier process than it is. We can hold public hearings ourselves and listen to what people have to say about a given project with information flow back and forth, and then integrate that into our considerations. We can wait till parties choose to intervene or not, and then listen to their point of view before we determine what we think is in the public interest. So.
I'd also just like to point out one of the things that you said was that the material and discussions that went into an MOU are subject to discovery. And I would just like to point out to you that I have witnessed multiple instances where the department and the utility's response has actually been that what were discussions in preparation for litigation.
Yes, I did not say that,
et cetera.
No. I said that the MOU itself was subject to discovery. People can ask me questions and do about what was the purpose of this MOU? What did you do to get to this point? How did you decide this? And yes, I'll stay away from discussing the actual negotiations. Those are protected in that process.
Right, and so I think my original point was that process actually ought to be open to all of the parties if you were going to create a settlement that you then intend to present as evidence that a project meets the Section 248 criteria. So if such an MOU is going to reopen a proceeding for evidentiary grounds, then it seems to me that private settlement between the department and the utility, the two entities with the most resources available, as well as all of the information, right? Without having to do discovery, without having to do anything else, right? There is a huge disproportionate power between the utility and the Department of Public Service that has chosen to support a project, right? So there's both the redundancy of litigation resources, right? As well as this hugely disproportionate amount of power that it would cost hundreds of thousands of dollars
for the other parties to actually get access to the information or be able to remount their arguments when something like an MOU at the 11th hour is done behind closed doors and then brought
to the
other
parties.
So you
don't want the MOU in the first hour, but you don't want it in the 11th
hour? No, I want the other parties to participate in it and to take into consideration the fact that this is actually an adversarial process. And the idea that some parties might try to delay the process of signing an MOU in order to stop the project, I'm sorry, but that's what an adversarial process looks like.
And that's why
the utilities use delay for regulatory purposes and for achieving their litigation ends all the time.
Thank you.
So you're sort of asking to bar one group because of their position, right? That's really the bottom line, is it's based upon they don't want the project, so we're going to bar it. I just want to mention one last thing in terms of the public advocate, which is there is a very simple solution to leveling the playing field and getting citizens real access and a fair shot in the litigation process, which is dollar for dollar what the utility spends on its own permitting and legal costs, have them put it into a fund to be distributed to citizens to spend themselves. Now, I know what the immediate response will be. That will get billed back to ratepayers and it will be more expensive. Well, it is the actual cost of vetting a project. And right now, you've had no problem with front-ending, for example, for the pipeline, setting aside funds of citizens to be used for development costs, including legal and permitting, before the utility has actually even gotten the project approved. And agreeing that that those costs could be covered even if the project isn't approved.
Are you talking about, you were talking about
the SERF.
Oh, the SERF. I'm sorry, I thought you were talking about the litigation monies that were given to property owners in advance.
No, that was something, right, that it's only because 10 landowners, right, came forward, pressured the governor, the utility actually ultimately agreed to it.
But you're just saying that if there needs to be a process for allowing for individuals to participate on at least as much an equal footing as possible.
I'd like to stay off this topic. There's some aspects of it that are possible.
That might still be
active. And exactly. I don't think we're here to talk about specific cases.
Thank you.
Right. I agree, although I would point out that virtually everything related to the pipeline is still under litigation. So by choosing not to have the members of this commission recuse themselves versus not discussing specific things, one of the problems is that you're not getting, you're getting very much a renewable picture.
To the public service board.
Right,
and
so my,
to stay on that topic.
Right, and my point is,
wait, before you finish, don't be defensive about that. Because this is a very real issue for people sitting at the table.
I understand.
But what we can do, and what I have asked folks to do who are engaged in the pipeline process and have been engaged in the past or of similar cases, is to generalize as much as possible, to take that information and to make recommendations that will help going forward without attribution to a given case.
And I actually didn't attribute it until I was asked purposely. I didn't mention what it was.
Okay.
I do recognize that it's recognizable because we only have one instance.
No, I'm glad you did, because I misunderstood where you were going with it, but once you mentioned it,
right.
I was like, okay.
But I guess my point is that we do have the possibility, I believe, that if those costs were, as I've said previously, front-ended and considered in the total cost-benefit analysis of the project rather than externalizing them to citizens. So if part of the utility's cost was to cover the same costs for citizens to vet the project as they spend to vet and defend the project, first of all, I think they would spend less on their legal costs, right? Because they also want to get their projects approved. So just from a market standpoint, that would likely reduce the costs, but it would also ensure that the playing field was fair. How those monies are distributed is a separate issue, but many systems have already resolved that problem. So it's not rocket science, and it's not that expensive to administer it. But I think that is actually your easiest answer, because then you don't have to deal with any of the other issues. If everybody is equally represented, is equally able to pay for experts, equally able to pay for attorneys, you are going to have a much more fair process fundamentally.
As long as you can identify the parties who would be participating.
Right. And I've recommended to DPS previously, I would look to the National Energy Board of Canada, which does this as a regularized process.
Right. So you need to have certain criteria in place for decision-making around that.
Right, and then people can pool their money, or they can choose to spend it individually. They can do whatever they want, but at least you know that an equal level of resources are being brought to both sides of a project. If these projects were not funded by ratepayers, if they were not part of a regulatory process and were being done on a market basis, then, you know, maybe that wouldn't be the way to go. But the fact is that these projects are being approved as public projects with all of the other things that go with the ability of the state to impose them on landowners, etc. And so that really changes the equation. If any utility wants to go through someone's property and pay market rates for it, right? Pay what the negotiated rate, which is what the landowner is willing to take from the utility on that day, then maybe this isn't necessary. But the fact is that you are actually allowing projects that come with eminent domain and with many other impositions on ratepayers of costs. And so you can force utilities to do some of the things that you wouldn't be able to in a market.
Good, thank you. Good. Judge Mellon, do you have any comments or questions?
No, it's in the court of law, there are very few parties, there's usually two, and there is no difference between access to the process and access to the decision maker, because in a court of law, the judge is supposed to decide things, or the jury, based solely on the information the parties have presented. Not newspapers, not governor's opinions, not what your local planning commission thinks, but on the evidence the parties have presented to us. So in a court of law, access to the process is access to the decision maker. And in the court of law, one party's going to win and the other party's going to lose. Does that mean that that party didn't get heard? Of course not. Does that mean the party didn't have representation and equal opportunity to have access? Of course not. It just means that in the court of law, we have disputes between people, individuals, and they're the ones who are interested in the outcome, and they clash. One has to win, and one has to lose. When you get into a situation where there's a public interest, it's a whole different ballgame. We almost never deal with the public interest in a court of law. We're dealing with disputes between individuals. But when you have the public interest, then that's no longer a judicial function. It becomes a quasi-judicial function. It's half legislative and half judicial. That's why it's quasi. There's a political component to deciding what is in the public interest. Who's going to decide what that interest is? Well, the Public Service Board in this case. Who's going to advocate for it? Well, there's a department to advocate the public's position. But when you have really complicated projects, there may be many public opinions, and they may all disagree with each other. Are you going to have 10 different advocates to present 10 different aspects of the public interest? And then there's another problem with the picture that has to be grappled with, and that is that there are, and this is the state level versus the local level, and this is a problem that's been part of our democracy since 1791 when we became a state. There are projects the state needs that are in the best interest of the public statewide that no community wants to see in their community. You can't have the communities have a veto over that. On the other hand, you can't have the state cramming down local people's throats to things they don't want in their backyard. And so trying to come up with a process that balances those is a major task. So here we've been presented with very strong feelings that this system as it exists now in the 248 process isn't working as well as it should. We have a small piece of that to try to address. And I know we're going to try to address that as best we can. We're not going to be able to solve all of these problems or all these issues, but they are there, and they're part of the picture.
Thank you.
I need to change the table.
Okay. So, well, the next side of the room will have to wait until this. Ready? Who's next?
Who's next?
If there's no one else, we should adjourn.
Well, can I take one more minute?
Sure. Steve, you got shortchanged earlier, but not by much.
Not by much. I'd like to point to a couple other suggestions that would make the process more. I don't know where to draw the line because I'm not an attorney and I don't practice before in within staff or anything. But if the board could occasionally explain its decisions or even admit a mistake, you know, that would go a long way towards people realizing this is a human process that is ours to own and fix, you know. And the example that comes to mind first is the failure of the board to do a rulemaking that was ordered in 2011 in Section 9 of Act 56 to conduct an expedited poll attachment dispute resolution process. And it was supposed to be done within 60 or 90 days of that hearing, of that act passing. And it was ignored. I'm told there was a workshop done, but there was no transcript made of the workshop. So here we are years later, and all of our broadband development is stagnated and delayed, and all those delays benefit the company. Secondly, and I'll reiterate, I made the point earlier, whose job is it to re-engage the public, to educate the capacity of the public to know about their opportunity and obligation to inform the 10-year planning process, and therefore the incentive regulation plans that derive from that, right? If the department didn't do its job for 10 years and all those people who cared or thought they were being heard, and now I literally have been told by several of the key players who have the most insight about that they cannot afford to speak up because this broadband grant program that's being, there was a meeting this morning to distribute those. So you've created some conflicts, similar with the information that we need to engage with the process. One statute says it's available, another statute says it's confidential. And if we can't know where our infrastructure is and therefore know how much it's going to cost to make it available elsewhere, then we can't build a video conferencing network. So
I'm trying to figure out which statute says it's not confidential and which one.
No, actually, 202D says that the department can request information from the companies on their telecommunications infrastructure under supervision of the board.
That's right.
So the board would then make the decision on where to draw the line between public and private.
Right.
Okay? Whereas you just passed under the new Connectivity Bill, Act 41, you passed a new ambiguous statute that says anything voluntarily given is automatically exempt, which therefore they're collecting everything voluntarily now. So we're not allowed to know where our fiber is, where our radios are, you know, etc. So we're stymied from actively participating in the planning, which is supposed to start over again in 17. These are some changes in statute that need to be made.
That's on the department's planning process that you're talking about, the BPA.
But also the board has the ability to hold hearings and even ed workshops, and that could go a long way towards re-engaging the. I know the AMOs could help bring a gathering of interested parties into a room, and the board can make a hold a workshop about what is our infrastructure, what can it do, what kind of decisions do we have to face in the next few years, and here's how to stay involved. Some of it may be more appropriate for the department, but they're not doing it. And therefore, you're not getting enough information to make good decisions at the board.
Let me comment on that, because I don't know how you can create statute or rules to address what you're talking about. So let me share with you that it's basically the style of the chair of the board that makes this stuff happen or it doesn't happen. And I'll go back and tell you that under Chairman Cowart and under Chairman Dworkin, these were two fellows who were totally publicly engaged with the public. They were actively engaged here in the State House. They were proactive. They told us what their opinions were. They told us what the policies should look like. Chairman Cowart led the charge to deregulate the power industry in this state. You know, and if that's not political, I don't know what is. But so there's nothing that says the head of the PSB can or cannot do that. Now, the current chair of the PSB chose to go in a totally different direction, which was to be out of sight, out of mind. That's my characterization of it. I did write them a letter telling them that they needed to engage more and that the public would be less upset if they simply issued press releases that said that this is why we did what we did. There's no law against them explaining what they do. So I don't know how you would, rulemake or legislate the style of the Public Service Board. But it's a very different animal depending on who the chair is.
I think that the Senate's consent, advice and consent process for the next board chair will be a place where you could vet out that issue. And it doesn't have to be a rubber stamp. I'd like to speak briefly to one point, to Judge Mello's comment, that it's an even playing field between the parties. And I often do public interest, public records litigation.
You're talking about in the courtroom.
Yes, in the courtroom. And I'm up against the full Attorney General's office, and they're defending a bad actor, which is an agency violating the law. And that's not a level playing field at all. I don't have the resources, and, the vital case currently pending in Superior Court, which you're not on, is one where the public interest is really at stake, $50 million of public money and no accountability. So I don't mean to argue with you. I'm just saying that it's the way the same funding, equalizing funding mechanisms that you're worth considering for Public Service Board process, we should consider for Superior Court process, because we don't have a public advocate.
So we don't have that charge.
I understand.
And so that would go to the Judiciary Committee.
I understand. I just say the more you're aware of it, the...
So I'm very
Connecticut
aware
has
of,
a Freedom of Information Commission.
I personally am very aware of the vital case.
Okay.
Because I have asked for years to have the intellectual property protected.
Okay.
That's been generated as a result of state.
Well, in the next, we have an oral argument next week. You're welcome to come. But I already fired my lawyer, so now I got to do it myself because I couldn't afford him.
Okay. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Does anyone else want to speak? Anyone?
It's been very helpful.
This has really been very helpful. It's been a great conversation, I hope. I hope you feel that way. We've got some really good comments here. And I think one of the things that we all need to understand is that we've identified probably more problems than we've been asked to resolve. So the increased citizen participation in the Public Service Board process, we can deal with somewhat, but we've also identified other areas that we can ask, at least for a conversation, whether it's at the board or at the in the legislature or in the department. So we will be beginning to look at our draft recommendations at our next meeting. We're going to go through the information that we have developed and gotten from folks since August, and we'll start putting things together. So, if you have your comments in writing, that would be very helpful. And I know that, I mean, just some bullets, the information that you've shared with us would be very helpful. Okay? So we have until 7:30 in case someone else walks through that door. And I am happy to sit here and listen.